This is Bill Nelson, the director of the Johns Hopkins Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center. And we're here today with Alana Fertig. And of course, one thing we're here to talk about is that Alana and her colleagues have secured a new grant to explore liver cancer, which is really growing in its effect on our society and throughout the world, but to study it in a brand new way. But this way involves the highest of high technologies and really is the interface between biology research, in other words, the sort of wet, stinky research, and information science, as we make measurements of extraordinary complexity, trying to make sense of it with computer-like kind of technologies. And I'll start with Alana. Alana, 3,088,286,401 base pairs in a human genome. How on earth are we going to study all of those in people and in their cancers versus their normal cells? How can we pull this off at all? How did you get into this business?
So I had a very non-straightforward path into this business, as I think many people in genomics did, where I started in a background in applied math and physics with applications to weather prediction and switched over to cancer biology during my postdoc. And one of the things that weather prediction provides is an amazing, in some ways, it's many years ahead of where we are in cancer biology, where there's very mature forecast systems to predict what's coming forward. And one of the biggest things that actually improved and enabled that was combining big data from satellites and weather balloons that are actually even probably a larger scale than what we get out of the genome with mathematical modeling to enable prediction. And when I entered the field, next-generation sequencing was just coming on board. And the other thing that I think is a little bit less popular, but was also just coming on board, was mathematical models to predict cancer systems. And what I saw was a real opportunity, looking back at the history of weather prediction, to think about how can we combine these to enable cancer forecasting. And one of the things I'm so excited about in this grant is it's not just combining the informatics and the big data, but it's also a way of combining mathematical modeling with that and really coming to realize some of those goals, which I'm really excited about.
The parallels with weather forecasting, that's very interesting. There's some aspects of mathematical approaches to science generally that I think is undergoing a renaissance in biology. Biology was probably the furthest from mathematical sciences. I mean, it has its origins in people looking at different birds and saying, oh, that feather is a different shape than that one, and they'd sketch it or something and then try to make sense of what that might mean for speciation in birds. But increasingly in biologic sciences, we're making measurements that are quantitative and more accurately so. We understand that although there's 3 billion base pairs in every cell in my body and every cell in your body, there are millions of differences between what we were born with and cancer, of course, are acquired defects in these same DNA molecules and whatnot. So we were never going to get very far, I guess you would argue. You weren't going to get very far predicting the weather until you had all the satellites up in the air making accurate measurements of temperature and wind patterns, et cetera, et cetera. We were never going to make great progress against cancer while we were finding one gene at a time and great expense. So you're arguing that weather forecasting sort of ripened up with the right technology and the right mathematics to think about how to model how they interact. And you're saying that genome sciences are reaching the same point? Is that your sense? Which is why we're attracting people like you into this field?
I mean, that's where I'm hoping we will reach. I don't think we've gotten there yet, but I think there's amazing new opportunities to study, you know, every single cell in the human body in addition to every single gene. And one of the big things that is enabled, I think, with mathematical sciences, like you're saying in biology, it's can I name this feather versus that? But there's not a lot of sense of what are the patterns, what are the shared features, how can we abstract this? And I think that's something that mathematicians can really bring to the field of what are the right variables? How can we abstract the things that we've thought of as being so disparate? And yes, maybe there are 3 billion base pairs, but maybe there's different combinations of them that work together in different patterns that are functioning together. And by understanding those components, maybe we'll get further.
Well, you can see that even in sort of non-cancer spaces where Clearly, the genes that you're born with affect the way you look. And the reason you know that is if you're an identical twin, you look a lot alike, your twin. But if you're not an identical twin, you may not look very much alike. If you're from a different race or ethnicity, which means the genes sort of diverged many, 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 many years ago, you might not look that similar. And yet we're not quite, but I'll bet you we're approaching the part where we can say, with this inventory of genes, can we predict what your face will look like? And we're not as far away from that, I believe, as people think. Have you seen that kind of...
I haven't seen face prediction. We're doing work also in retinal development, where we've gotten data and genome scale from the developing retina over time with collaborators, Seth Blackshaw and Loyal Goff. And we've been using that data from the genome scale to predict what are the different developmental trajectories and what are the gene combinations associated with that. And we're showing that by using the patterns that we get in that scale, we're doing a very good job of being able to trace the developing systems.
So for our listeners, right, a little biology. So probably at this point, 20,000-ish genes mm-hmm. being the blueprints for protein, which are the components of the cells and the tissues in the body. But that's just the beginning of how complicated they are, because every cell doesn't have every gene at the same time. There are minor nuanced differences, even in a single gene, for different proteins it can make through some genetic mechanisms. And so trying to fit together which of these components are in each cell, and then say, with these components, your fate is to become a normal blood-forming cell. If you have defects in some of these components, you don't become a retina cell in the eye, you become a cancer that threatens your life. That's the kind of logic you're trying to assemble, right?
Exactly. And maybe also by understanding what the patterns are in a normal system, can you then develop techniques, if you know what's normal, to look at what's varying from that and where things are going wrong to cause cancer?
Well, and the other, of course, is an old, for lack of a better description, fantasy in cancer treatment is that if you have cells that have a trajectory, you have cells in the skin that are going to become a skin cell in a particular way to cover your body so you don't, you know, leak fluids and don't get infected and the like. As you become a skin cancer, that specialized activity, there's usually a caricature of it that remains, probably because many of the components remain, and then there's something that undermines its ability to fully execute that life fate, and so they become cancerous, they go out through the body. Well, one treatment fantasy is, can you redirect them back to what they were supposed to be doing? Any sense as to how hard that seems from a mathematical modeling perspective? Is that going to be hard to do?
I think it's going to be very hard, because one of the things that we tend to see is a lot of the tools that we're developing actually work better in developmental biology than they do in cancer, because developmental biology is so constrained, whereas cancer is so heterogeneous and so diverse in the ways it works. So as soon as you find one mechanism to counteract something, unfortunately, cancer cells are smart enough to come at you with another one. And they're a little bit too smart, I think, to be easily rewired. Or maybe they're not that smart at all, and they've just done so many diverse things that everything is already there for them to have those mechanisms.
Well, you have, in work that you've participated in and driven, you've explored these issues of, in a cancer, as you have, you know, billions of cells, that no two cells are exactly alike in the defects in their genome or in the components that they're producing, so they're unlikely to behave the same. And as you mentioned, this gives them some adaptive properties collectively, that they can outfox our radiation therapy, they can outfox our chemotherapy, and even though immunotherapy is really moving in a good direction, of course, the worry is that they might be able to outfox that as well. How prevalent is this heterogeneity in all the types of analyses you've done? I know you've done many. And how intractable a problem is this going to be?
The heterogeneity is very, very prevalent. What I think we don't know is, if we attack something, can we delay the new mechanism from outgrowing in a time scale that is sort of longer than a person's natural lifespan? And I think that that's been some of the great work being done at Moffitt Cancer Center and other places where people are looking at mathematical modeling to try to think about, can you delay the timing of this long enough and maybe not think about cancer as a constant war against, you know, killing off cancer cells, but think of it as more of a chronic condition where we're trying to track it, monitor it, and change treatments to delay what's going on.
Yeah, you're raising so many fascinating points. One thing is it's interesting to see yet another parallel back to weather forecasting is that many of the technologies that we've had to examine cancers and to analyze them in one way or another innately sample these cancers at one particular time. So you remove them surgically, you take the cancer, you fix it in formaldehyde so it doesn't decompose, you embed it in candle wax, you slice it in tiny ways, and you look at it under the microscope. Even when we remove the DNA and the RNA and all these kind of things and analyze this with all kinds of high technology things, that's still at one time. And yet weather forecasting, I suspect they call this initial conditions rather than, but it's what evolves over time. Of course, that happens in developmental biology too. Are we missing that in cancer a little bit?
I mean, that's the basis of most of my research, is that I do think we're missing that. And I think that we're missing critical pieces of timing about how things are being regulated, and also in terms of how we're treating patients and how we're talking to patients, you know, giving somebody a lifetime risk of being cured, your, you know, disease recurrence at 10 years versus the way we handle weather in terms of recognizing our limitations and where we can predict and saying, okay, you know, maybe I can really accurately predict where you're going to head in 3 months, and that's all I really know. And I can give you that certainty, and then you come back and you go back to the clinic. I think that might be a much better reflection of the system and our limits of prediction than thinking about it as this long-term outcomes.
Yeah, no, I think there are many reasons, I think, at this point to believe that the system of saying what was the median tendency of a large group of people, let's say, with prostate cancer treated in one way, that median survival, which innately has a distribution, and you know, from the patient perspective, if you say, you know, in groups of men like this in the past, that half of them, you know, lived 5 years. Well, if you just live a year, that's of no consolation to you. Meantime, if you happen to live 10 years, that the fact that somebody else lived 5 years makes you become a disease advocate and you want to help other people. But it's not really giving individualized prediction very well in an era where we're trying to argue that one person's cancer is measurably different than another person's prostate cancer. We can measure the difference in genes and RNA and whatnot. And you think that may enable us greater precision in predicting what will happen over the short term, but the long term, unless we start measuring time-dependent things, it's going to be hard. Is that sort of where you're at in your mind?
Yeah, that's what's on my mind. I mean, one of the nice things about math is, you know, things are true or not, which is certainly not the case in biology. And, you know, coming from, you know, background in nonlinear dynamics and chaos theory, as you were saying with initial conditions, you know, sort of the proof of that is if you have a complex system that's changing over time, your errors are going to double and eventually you can't predict it. And that's provable. That's why we can't get weather forecasts out longer than 10 days. So I think we haven't explored that aspect of how complex tumors are at all. I don't think we know, are they chaotic? Are they deterministic? I don't think we know any of that. And without knowing that, I don't think we know what we can and can't predict. And I do think that if we have this dynamical systems perspective where we're tracing the tumors and reflecting the fact that they're evolving, I think it will help with prediction, with coming up with how are the molecular changes occurring, when are they occurring, how can we select a new drug and the right drug to give people and really help prolong their lives.
So this gives an interesting opportunity to come up for air for a second, and that is that when you describe chaotic behavior and sort of chaos theory, you mean something very specific as different from random-like behaviors. And I always viewed sort of chaos theory as there's sort of a random appearance, but there's intent behind every particular event or something. Can you give us a good chaos theory definition for our listeners? Who will be curious?
Yeah. So the idea behind chaos theory is that it's most famously characterized through the butterfly effect. And that's, you know, if a butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, you might have a tornado there tomorrow that wasn't today. And the idea behind it is that if you have these systems that are changing over time and you have a lot of pieces that are interacting in complex ways, maybe, I don't know, there's a chance of running into somebody on the street, or there's a chance of it raining that you're not accounting for. Even if you could account for all of those random variables perfectly, if you were to take some system that modeled all of that to 100% accuracy, if you change just your estimate of where things are at the initial time, like maybe somebody's sitting in a different place or the butterfly is flapping its wings, even with 100% accurate mathematical model, just changing what you put in at the start will change where you end up. And that change will increase over time. So initially, it's going to look very, very close together. And then what's going to happen is, as you run that mathematical model longer and longer and longer, it's going to get further and further apart. And eventually, the two systems will be completely unrelated, even though they're using exactly the same mathematical model to trace everything, just because you may have a very, very subtle difference in what you're putting in the beginning.
So here's... You know, there are so many vistas in the cancer enterprise that are going to benefit from this type of thinking. And part of it, as we mentioned earlier, is because we can now make measurements more accurately with more features of the cancer cells and the environment in which they find themselves than ever before. And also we have the computational power with the microprocessors such that we can ask these questions more substantially. So with individual cancer cells behaving differently, with some chaotic aspects of how they can evolve over time, one hopeful thought is that the immune system has been crafted in such a way to be adaptive, to be able to chase after these things, presumably for infections and whatnot, but perhaps for cancer as well. And where are we at in your mind with the mathematical modeling of the immune system?
That is a very complicated question. And I have the good fortune, again, on this liver cancer grant, you know, it's focused not on the immune system, but we have the good fortune that the mathematical tools that are being developed for the modeling by my collaborator, Sasha Popel, on that have both cell signaling, which is the interaction between genes, and also the interaction with the immune system.
Well, you'll be looking at, with the cell biology colleagues you have, you'll be looking at cells, cancer cells, normal cells, completely apart from all these things, getting a sense of putting them through their paces like a workout.
Yeah.
What happens when you give them this stimulation or that? Inventorying their behaviors and trying to get a sense of that, and then you'll be able to look at them in their own habitat, in a sense, both, right?
I mean, that's what's so exciting about this grant is, so Futran has developed very nice models of liver invasion along with Andy Ewald, also has developed other models that let us query different aspects of interaction between cancer cells and their environment. And one of the things, getting back to chaos theory, is that in spite of this difficulty predicting, even if you don't have a great mathematical model, one of the things that's been shown is you can actually trace the system for a long time just by putting observations back in of the system at regular time periods. And so with this liver cancer grant, with having these biological models and then having these mathematical models from Sasha Popel that are also bringing together how predicting the future of these systems, and then my work in informatics, we can think about taking this genetic information that we're getting over different time points, putting it into the mathematical model, and maybe neither my genetics nor Sasha's math modeling is perfect, but the combination we're hoping is going to bring us to better predictions and better forecasting of therapeutic response than we could get along.
Yeah. No, that's that's extremely interesting. I actually had found myself a number of years ago at a think tank with a diversity of scientists, including physicists, mathematical modelers, but ecologists and folks like this. And one of the thoughts that I garnered from people outside of the cancer research universe that was interesting to me was, with these issues of heterogeneity, there was this notion of group selection. I think the example that was used was were these beetles, and my memory is there's one beetle that's monstrous and a whole bunch of little kind of worker beetles, and the ratio of the number of little worker beetles to monster beetle was actually driven by a single gene that you could have a variant and it would change the ratio. And that was a selected, in terms of Darwinian selected, trait depending on which tree you're on or, you know, wherever they crawl over. And the argument is that it wasn't selecting, if you will, for little beetles. It wasn't selecting for big beetles. It was selecting for the group of them. And I had always worried that you look at these features in cancer cells that make them different from each other, that may make them very powerful when it comes to, unfortunately, growing in the wrong place as a metastasis, threatening your life, outfoxing the immune system, that together with all these different variations and whatnot, that they're very hard to chase after. Is that still your sort of worry about this?
Yes, but I think for short periods of time we can start thinking about this. So I think there's always going to be some dominant mechanism and something that, given infinite time or infinite opportunity, will be able to take over. I think that's pretty provable. But I think if you can think about how to trace it and how to intervene with what's dominant at any given time point, then maybe we'll have better ways of managing that, account for that, and start thinking about that. And well, taking advantage of the immune system and other systems as well.
Well, I'll tell you one thing to ponder how, as you mentioned, as you begin to explore this in a setting of a real cancer with, you know, treatment interventions and the like, is if you look at the way we treat advanced cancers or have for the last few decades, we'll have somebody with a significant life-threatening cancer that we can see distributed throughout their body on some kind of scan, and we can see where the tumors are. We give some kind of treatment that we expect to be helpful, and then we try and make another measurement, another scan, perhaps 3 weeks or 6 weeks later, and we're really asking, did it work, not is it working? And so one question is analogous to weather forecasting. I can tell you it's going to be hotter generally in the summer than the winter. That's not helpful because everybody knows that. But to your point is that by using these kind of things, and we deliver a perturbation of treatment, by the technologies and the thoughts you're having, we may be able to, like the weather, say this is likely to be working or likely not to be working, i.e. maybe we should think of another strategy without having to wait 6 weeks to make that decision. Is that something you could see even as a near-term benefit?
Absolutely. And that's something I know that actually one of my former PhD advisors, where we were working on that problem in weather prediction, he's applied that approach to studying brain tumors to think about predicting where the surgical margins are, and based on combining imaging with mathematical models, thinking about, can you predict where the margins will be and where they will grow to later intervene and just keep sort of nudging that.
Well, this has been tremendous. We've been able to talk about everything from high-order mass, chaos theory, big data science, and the like, all being applied to cancer, and all, we hope, going to change the outlook for people to be diagnosed with cancer in the future. Thanks again, all of you, for listening. For more about all the great work we're doing here at the Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center, follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Hopkins Kimmel. And please take time to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes.